Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And thanks to all of you here in America and to all of you at the other events all over the world who are still connected to us live on this historic day. You are Live Earth.
Former vice president, now rock concert promoter, apparently, Al Gore, at the Meadowlands Saturday, introducing our local stage in the Live Earth concert. If he is thinking of running for president, not a bad campaign stage, right, while he waits to see if the current contenders implode. Meanwhile, this week in Washington is shaping up to contain another showdown on the Iraq war and another showdown between Congress and the president. With respect to the war, here is Senator Chuck Schumer on CBS Face the Nation yesterday.
I think the dam is about to burst. There are Republican senators who have been holding up a reasonable change in policy on this war are going home and getting hammered by their constituents, and they're beginning to change. If not this July, by September, there will be real change forced upon the president by a bipartisan Senate.
And on the politics of investigation, this just in from the Associated Press a little while ago, it says President Bush has invoked executive privilege this morning to deny requests by Congress for testimony from former White House aides Sarah Taylor and Harriet Myers. The White House offered once more to make the pair available for private off-the-record interviews on any role it might have played in the firings of several U.S. attorneys. But in a letter to the heads of the House and Senate Judiciary panels, White House counsel Fred Fielding insisted that Bush was acting in good faith and refused lawmakers' demand that the president explain the basis for invoking the privilege he has not. Executive privilege invoked this morning by the Bush White House. With me now to talk about all of this is USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Can you explain the breaking news? What is this executive privilege that the president has invoked?
Well, this is something presidents since George Washington have talked about, that there is it's not spelled out in the Constitution, but a kind of implicit right of presidents to get candid and private advice from their advisors. There have been a lot of confrontations about this over the years. It's generally been something that Congress and the White House works out in some way to avoid the kind of showdown that you might see, say, in a Supreme Court decision, although it did go to the Supreme Court in the case of the Watergate scandal. So I think that we see this showdown kind of looming, but I wouldn't necessarily assume that it gets to the final stages, because in the past we've seen several different White Houses and Congresses controlled by different parties be able to work out some deal at some point that satisfies both sides.
And what is it that Congress wants here exactly? They want Harriet Myers and Sarah Taylor to testify about what?
They want them to testify about how the decision was made to fire those nine U.S. attorneys, which has become so controversial.
Mm-hmm.
What role the White House might have played in that, and specifically whether members of the Justice Department misled Congress in testifying about how those decisions were made. You remember those Justice Department officials, including Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, have downplayed any White House role in that decision-making process.
So critics are going to say, well, they're hiding something.
Yes, and the critics also hope that the fact that these two women no longer work for the president might make them more likely to testify, less likely to kind of hang tough on it. There are various people they could have gone after who still work in the White House, like Karl Rove. Instead, they chose to go after two aides who have left the president's employ.
Republicans, I guess, will say the Democrats are going on a fishing expedition. Are the Democrats being explicit about what they hope to get from these two?
Well, they might argue a fishing expedition, and they might also argue that any president, Democrat or Republican, needs to be able to get advice that they know will not be kind of dragged before the light of day, that you want to be able to have a candid discussion where people could make say what they wish, where you might have outrageous suggestions made.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the fundamental argument, is one that is not specific to this case, but that any president deserves that kind of candid advice.
It came up during Watergate as an example of Nixon stonewalling, right? He invoked executive privilege in order ordered a stonewall.
He did. And that was the case that went to the Supreme Court and resulted in a decision that said presidents do deserve a certain privilege to have candid and private advice, but that it's not absolute, and that in the case, that the specific case that was before the court in the Watergate matter, the White House was ordered to cooperate with the Congress. But it even that court decision, which now, of course, is a couple decades old, recognized that it's a balancing right, not an absolute right on either side.
So is this headed for court?
Well, it certainly may be, because there are certainly the Democrats in Congress feel, that they were not, that there was not accountability for this administration while Republicans controlled Congress, and they're trying to rectify that. Democrats have not had such a successful time in actually passing legislation since they took over after the 2006 election, but they have had some success in pursuing investigations into administration actions at the Justice Department and as regards the war in Iraq, and this would be an example of that. So I don't see either side backing down soon.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, my guest on WNYC. Iraq, we played that Chuck Schumer clip from Face the Nation. I thought Congress was waiting until General Petraeus issues his troop surge report that he promised for September. Why is the withdrawal debate coming up again right now?
Well, I think things are really accelerating, in part because of the deterioration in the security situation in Iraq and deterioration in public support for the war here at home. The White House the administration is preparing an interim report for July 15th. It's due on Sunday. And the early story in the New York Times a couple days ago said that the administration will be able to have clear progress on not one of the 18 benchmarks that the president set up in January when he unveiled his new strategy toward Iraq. That Iraq is not on course to reach any one of those 18 by the deadline that the president set. Not a deadline for withdrawal, but the president set up these benchmarks in January to address concerns of Congress that the Iraqis weren't being held accountable. This is very bad news. We've seen some for the administration. We've seen some of the most senior and respected Republican senators, including Richard Lugar, who was formerly chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Pete Domenici, who's been into the Senate forever. He's a six-term senator. Both say that it's time now to get out of Iraq. And I would just say, I think even more significant is some comments from Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader. We had a reporter, Kathy Kiley, out with him when he went home to Kentucky toward the end of last week. And let me just read a quote that's in our paper today. Mm-hmm. He said, "The majority of the public has decided the Iraq effort is not worth it. That puts a lot of pressure on Congress to act because public opinion in a democracy is not irrelevant."
That is such a thing for Mitch McConnell to say, because he's such a staunch partisan.
Well, and he's the guy who's in charge of rounding up the troops for President Bush. He's saying that the public has decided it's not worth it and that Congress should pay attention to that. That is the most alarming thing I think I've seen of all the developments for the White House in terms of making its case with Congress. And we have a big Senate debate this week on a huge defense authorization bill. There are going to be a lot of amendments offered on that to go to the war.
Here, though, is Republican Senator Orrin Hatch on CBS Face the Nation yesterday with his take on what Senator Pete Domenici did and did not really mean when he called for a change of policy last week.
Pete Domenici was not calling for us to immediately leave. He's calling us to work towards withdrawing the troops over there, and I think that's different from what the president really wants, and there are a few others doing that, but on the other hand, I don't think any major Republican is calling for us to just precipitously leave there and leave that place in a mess.
So, Susan Page from USA Today, can you clarify this for us further? If Domenici and Lugar and Voinovich of Ohio is another one in the last week or so, are all calling for a change of policy to get Americans out of Iraq, a change of direction with respect to Iraq, but without a timeline, what exactly are they saying?
Well, I think they're saying that I think this is all the audience for these comments that Lugar and Voinovich and Domenici made in the past a week or so. The audience for that is not other senators or even people from their home states. The audience is at the White House. The audience is the president. This is, they're just saying to the president, you cannot count on us to continue to support you unless you change course in Iraq. And what could change course mean? I mean, Bush has been extremely resistant to ideas of setting a firm timetable for withdrawal, for instance. But he could be pushed into making some real compromises if he can't count on people like Lugar and Domenici. These are not the showboaters in the Senate who try to get out there, always on the Sunday shows, trying to get headlines. You know, Lugar did his speech kind of in the middle of the night without telling us it was coming. It took us 2 or 3 days to catch up to it. I mean, that's because he wasn't speaking to us. He was speaking to George Bush.
That's interesting. Now, are all three of those senators up for re-election next year?
Yes, I believe all three. Now, is that true? I don't actually know that.
I'm not sure. I think at least I'm pretty sure Lugar is, and I'm pretty sure Domenici is. So were they also speaking to their home state constituents?
I believe Domenici and Voinovich both are. But, you know, Lugar, I can't believe, is in any threatened
situation. Because he's an institution.
In Indiana. It is true. It is definitely true. I know for a fact that the GOP senators we're looking at now to see if they also break ranks with the White House are those who have faced re-election fights next year, like Saxby Chambliss from Georgia or Norm Coleman from Minnesota or Pat Roberts in Kansas. Even in states that Republican senators ought to feel pretty safe in, like Kansas and Wyoming and Oklahoma, there is concern that this is going to be a very bad year to be a Republican if the situation in Iraq remains where it is now.
One Republican senator who has long been critical of the war is Chuck Hagel. He was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, and here's his take on Domenici.
One thing we cannot continue to do, the American people won't allow it, the Congress won't, is to continue to put our men and women in the middle of a civil war. Our policies first for the United States should be worthy of the sacrifices our men and women make. It is not today. It is not a workable policy. So that means we're going to have to shift. That's what the Pete Domenici piece was about. That's what Dick Lugar and George Voinovich and others have been talking about.
So, Susan, how exactly will the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, try to push the issue this week?
Well, Senator Reid indicated in the last few days that he's going to allow these amendments to come forward, put the weight of the Democratic leadership behind them. There are a series of amendments that would do various things. One would revoke the authorization for the war. Now, that's not probably a resolution that has much immediate effect, but it might have some symbolic power.
If they actually passed it with over 50 votes, it would have a huge symbolic effect, wouldn't it?
Huge symbolic effect. But if your goal which
would start to have a practical effect. I'm just guessing here. Yeah. Tell me if you disagree.
I don't think it necessarily has a practical effect because Bush is the commander in chief. The real power of Congress is to cut off funding for the war. Senators and members of Congress in both parties are very reluctant to do that because of fear that it puts soldiers in the field at risk. You know, you don't want to do anything that seems directed at the troops rather than at the leadership of the war. So while revoking the original authorization for the war, not saying they could pass that, but that's one of the amendments that's going to come forward, I don't think that's one of the more serious amendments in terms of actually getting things done. The serious amendments would say if Iraq doesn't meet these five benchmarks by this date, then we will begin a drawdown of U.S. forces by this date.
We can take phone calls for Susan Page, by the way, with all of this going on in Washington right now, USA's Washington Bureau Chief, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or leave a comment or a question on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You know what I'm still fundamentally confused about? I mean, the politics of all of this is one thing, but does anyone really know what kind of new war policy Congress would enact if the Democrats push this to whatever, you know, final degree they might push it? If there really is a Shiite on Sunni genocide with no U.S. troops, as Senator McCain predicts, and if al-Qaeda really sets up a global base in a more overt way in Iraq, all the Democrats say, or almost all the Democrats say, well, we should still be fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq, what's the U.S. policy going to actually be?
Well, there's. I don't think there's. You may be confused because it's not clear what the
it's a good reason to be confused.
But there has Senator Biden, who's of course the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and one of the Democratic, one of the many Democrats running for the presidential nomination, has long proposed this three-state, one-nation solution, where the United States basically supports the idea of three federated states in Iraq, one predominantly Sunni, one predominantly Shiite, one predominantly Kurd, Kurdish, and that's gained some credibility. Certainly, he's been promoting that idea. The other thing that we hear the Democratic presidential candidates talking about is not pulling every U.S. soldier back to the United States, but rather redeploying them to bases in Kuwait and perhaps in Jordan, where they would be a kind of rapid deployment force ready to strike at an al-Qaeda base if they needed to. And Hillary Clinton actually has talked about leaving some troops in Iraq to protect the Kurds, to protect U.S. interests, including the U.S. embassy there. So even the Democrats who are most adamantly against the war talk about what you do next and what forces do you leave in the region.
So if Harry Reid pushes the Senate to vote on something like redeployment, it is completely unclear what that would mean. And that would start a long process of what? Negotiation between congressional leaders and General Petraeus?
And, you know, one reason this is so difficult is because of the warnings, not just from President Bush, but also from others, about the consequences of a big drawdown of U.S. combat forces. We think there's a civil war now. What kind of catastrophe might follow? What kind of chaos? What happens to Iraqis who have been supportive of our efforts and been friends to us? So it's not, I think it is not one of those questions on which there is a simple and clear answer around which people are coalescing. What you do see is people saying, what we're doing now is not working, it's costing too much, the violence is too much, the chances of victory are too low. We want to do something else.
We'll continue in a minute with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. You mentioned Senator Clinton's presidential campaign. When we come back, we will hear a clip of what Bill Clinton says he might like to be called if he returns to the White House. And we will take your phone calls and comments and continue on some of these issues, including the Iraq War. Brian Lehrer and WNYC.
What would be your preference? First gentleman or first man?
I think the Scottish friends of mine have suggested I should be called the first laddie.
First laddie? Why not? President Clinton speaking at a global warming conference in Aspen over the weekend, where he was interviewed by Richard Stengel, managing editor of Time magazine. We continue with USA Today, Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Now, Susan, first laddie. Clinton chalks it up to the Scottish, but maybe it's really that he reads those laddie magazines.
Could be.
One of the big political stories this week was the emergence of Bill Clinton on the campaign trail for his wife. Why now?
Well, I think, at some point it was going to happen, and it certainly gives Senator Clinton kind of a publicity boost, a boost. They went to the two early states where she's hoping to win both of them, Iowa, the Iowa caucuses, and New Hampshire primary. And so, why not? And it was never going to be that Bill Clinton would not appear with Senator Clinton on the campaign trail. So, I guess they figured it was about time.
Yeah. Is it a sign of trouble that it was now? We certainly see the fundraising numbers, which, I mean, she had no lack of money, but Barack Obama is making big headlines, beating the world.
Nobody gets handed a presidential nomination, by and large. It's an unusual year in which you can just walk, where it's a cakewalk, so to speak, to get a presidential nomination. You know, her people would acknowledge that Senator Obama's developed an enormous amount of interest and excitement. The fact that he's gotten 250,000 people to contribute to his presidential campaign is incredible and a sign of real buzz. On the other hand, they point out that she's done well in the debate. debate. She's looked very confident. She continues to lead by a wide margin in the USA Today Gallup poll, which is, by the way, the only poll you should pay attention to.
Of course.
And she's done a little better in Iowa. You know, she was doing so poorly in Iowa at one point that there was speculation by one of her staffers that maybe she should skip it. Now some polls show her closing in on Obama and Edwards, both of whom once led her in Iowa. So I guess I don't really see it as a mm-hmm. sign of trouble. It's a sign of a presidential campaign that's got, you know, months and months more to go.
You mentioned the USA Today Gallup poll, and I want to ask you about some eye-popping numbers from that poll with respect to congressional approval. Mm-hmm. We keep hearing how low President Bush's approval numbers are, and I don't have the number in front of me. Maybe you remember it, but there, wasn't it something like 24% or something like
yeah.
that, the approval rating for Congress right now?
Approval rating for Congress has been lower than the approval rating for the president, and I'll tell you a more eye-popping number, which was 14% of Americans say they have a favorable view toward Congress.
That's 14.
That's different than the job approval. Do you think Congress is doing a good job? But we ask favorable, unfavorable, and that is the lowest since Gallup started asking that question.
What is the difference between favorable, unfavorable, and job performance?
Well, they're different. They're different things. You know, for a long time, people, and this, I don't know if this is still the case. I bet it is. People had a more favorable view of President Bush than they had of his job approval rating. They liked him better than they had a favorable opinion of him. And I think this is straining my memory, but I think the reverse was true with President Clinton. During the Monica Lewinsky affair, his favorable rating went down. People thought he was kind of a scoundrel, but his job approval rating remained high. So you're actually asking about slightly different things when
yeah.
you ask those two questions.
So does your poll indicate why people are judging Congress so harshly now?
Well, I think that some of the people who voted for a Democratic Congress expected more to get done than it's gotten done. You know, they've passed an increase in the minimum wage, which is one of the things they promised to do. But action on the war in Iraq, for instance, has been pretty slow to come by. And some of their action on congressional ethics has, I think, been disappointing to some people in the public as well.
Let's take a phone call. Brian in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
All right.
Back with regard to the options of what happens if the Dems take their argument to a logical conclusion and U.S. withdraws, I think because the U.S. went into Iraq alone, essentially, that many, the media and many politicians included, have fallen into the mindset that the options are either all U.S. troops all in or U.S. troops all out, and which is really a false choice. If the U.S. withdraws, the logical, what will happen is they'll be replaced by a truly international effort that will have a focus on a political resolution and peacekeeping. An international coalition means actually having regional forces in there from the Middle East.
Wait a minute, who are all these other countries that are going to suddenly send their troops to Iraq?
Well, Brian, it's the same countries that, I mean, obviously countries have a vital stake in Iraq. That's the way we see that a destabilized Iraq is not in our interest. Those who are closest to it see that same point. So I think the problem has historically been here. It hasn't been that people aren't willing to step up the plate. It's been the parameters that the Bush administration mm-hmm. has put on that stepping up that have made it untenable.
If they look like U.S. poodles, they're not going to do it.
Correct.
If they don't, they may do it. Thank you for your call. Susan Page, is this being talked about in Washington? Is this anybody's idea of a realistic prospect?
Well, we're so. I think that there is no expectation that other troops would move into Iraq, especially given the situation hard even for the U.S. military to manage, the best military in the world. It's hard to imagine that countries in the region would agree to send in troops that would try to keep a peace in Iraq. I think that is just not one of the things on the table. Now, maybe if the U.S. pulled out, there would be a greater regional effort at peacekeeping. You know, maybe you'd see Saudi Arabia, which has stepped up somewhat in the last 6 months or so on peacekeeping in the Middle East, or you could see maybe Jordan, but, I mean, I think that is not a prospect that anyone here sees as being realistic.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Coming up in 10 minutes, we will look at New York City's new push to get you to drink the tap water, and we will have an environmentalist on to compare the health and environmental risks and benefits and also the taste of New York City tap water versus bottled water. But let's take another phone call. This is Hoshiar, who identifies as an Iraqi-Canadian citizen, calling from Kingston, Canada. Hoshiar, thanks so much for listening to WNYC on the web. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. Basically, what I'm trying to make two points, and I also want to answer your other caller, the problem with that solution he's proposing. First of all, I think the Democratic Party is quite misled, because if they withdraw, there will be a bloodbath in Iraq. The second thing, the Bush administration have not come to realization that Iraq cannot be a unified country. Iraq was gobbled together from different groups, and the three main groups, and I think Senator Biden's solution is the best one. As far as the regional power, each regional power has very specific interests in Iraq, and therefore it cannot work. We cannot, I mean, Iraqi Kurds cannot accept Turkey because Turkey doesn't recognize the Kurds. Similarly for Iran or Saudi Arabia, I think that's just another recipe for disaster. United States has to stay there, but they have to find a reasonable political solution in Iraq.
What's going to push the powers that be to that reasonable solution? That's one of the main reasons that
the main thing is that the Bush administration have to accept and also ignore the Iraqi, the neighbors. They don't accept the central problem of Iraq, that Iraq is not a unified country. The only reason they don't accept it because of their relationship with Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and that's the crux of the matter. They have to accept that if they are going to have a solution in Iraq, they have to create, they have to establish a federal system of three main reasons, mm-hmm. and they may have to move people around, just like what they did in Yugoslavia. That's basically that way it boils down. They put the leaders in Daytona for 30 days, and yes. they have to come to an agreement, and they have to look at their security.
Right, like the Dayton Peace Accords, yes. you're saying, where they were locked in a room
I
by Richard Holbrooke and said, solve it.
They want to solve the problem in Iraq, but also they want to pacify Turkey and Saudi Arabia and the Arab countries.
Very interesting.
They cannot have it both ways.
By the way, we've now had calls on the show this morning from London, England, and from Kingston, Canada. Hoshyar, can I ask you how you know the show up there?
What?
How do you know about us?
Well, I mean, I listen. I'm a physician. When I'm not seeing patients, I usually listen to your show.
Thank you very much.
I'm in my office.
Yes, and thank you very much for your call. And I think Susan Page an important perspective. And actually, it recalls what you said earlier about what Biden, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, might actually push if the Republicans show some movement to, start pressuring the president to change the status quo, and that is trying to move to this three-region setup. But if they do that, that doesn't mean pulling out American troops in 3 weeks.
Also, the administration has been quite resistant to this idea. It would mean, as Hoshyar said, acknowledging that there's no peaceful possibility, that people of different from different sects couldn't live side by side in the same neighborhood. That'd be a big step for the administration to take. And I think one thing that's pretty clear is that there is not a good, simple, neat option left in Iraq. It's not as though someone has an answer and we just haven't thought of it yet. All the options have big downsides and risks involved with them. And the question now is, which of these bad options are we going? Which of these bad mm-hmm. paths are we going to take? Which risk are we most willing to accept?
We have about 5 minutes left with Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, Susan Page, here on WNYC. One more issue. It looks like President Bush commuting Scooter Libby's sentence is going to have ramifications in Congress this week. Here is House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers on ABC This Week.
Well, what we're trying to do is to find out what the purpose of the commutation was, and also where we should be going in these kinds of activities of pardons, clemency, and commutation.
So, Susan Page, the purpose of the commutation, he says, everybody agrees the president may, by law, commute the sentence. But there's an argument, and I think Conyers articulated this elsewhere, that says President Bush, in effect, may be letting himself off the hook because Libby was the fall guy for the whole Iraq war opponent smear campaign. If his sentence is commuted, he's no longer under pressure to cooperate with the prosecutor and maybe give up information on his superiors, who happen to be Cheney and Bush. Do you think there's something to that in terms of the way the investigation is actually working at this point?
Well, you know, I think that it seemed as though the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, thought that might be the case, and that's why he pushed so hard with Libby. Was he protecting others in the administration in this case? But, you know, Scooter Libby did not offer him much satisfaction during the investigation, even during a trial and after being sentenced. So I'm not sure what else you do. And one of the realities is, you know, the president's power to offer executive clemency is one of those absolute powers in the Constitution. We saw that with the case with when President Clinton issued all those pardons on his way out the door, including to Mark Rich. As you can think it's good or bad, you can think it's outrageous, you can think there's some motive behind it, but it is one of those absolute powers. We talked about executive privilege before, not an absolute power. The power to exercise clemency is one of those absolute constitutional powers. So you can investigate, but you know the fact is there's not much you can do about it.
And on Patrick Fitzgerald's investigation, is there anything left to it? Hasn't he said he's not going to indict anyone else in the CIA leak case?
I think we think it's over. Now there's some thought, will he go and testify before Congress? We've heard Chuck Schumer, your senator from New York, talk about that yesterday on one of the shows, Sunday shows, whether perhaps Patrick Fitzgerald might have something interesting to offer. But I think that inquiry is basically done.
Before you go, I want to play one more clip of Senator Chuck Hagel on Meet the Press. There has been speculation about a Bloomberg-Hagel independent presidential ticket ever since the two had dinner together in May. And, of course, Hagel already has a reputation as a Republican maverick. Here's what Hagel said on Meet the Press when asked about that yesterday.
I have no intention of changing parties. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that I don't think an independent does not have some renewed possibilities next year.
Why did he throw that in about the renewed possibilities?
I don't know. And why did he use the word intention, which isn't exactly a Sherman-esque statement that you would never, ever consider doing it? What are you looking forward to, a New York race of Giuliani versus Clinton versus Bloomberg? New York, once again, kind of the center of the entire universe.
That would absolutely be too much fun, but I think it's highly unlikely. Personally, I tend to think that Bloomberg will look at the prospects and decide not to run. But, of course, there's always the possibility that he will. I don't think he's made up his mind yet. And, you know, I think it's possible that he could decide to run even if he thinks he can't win, if he could influence the debate in a way that's really important to him. But what's the Washington Press Corps saying about this?
About the Bloomberg guy, Bloomberg prospect, I think taking it pretty seriously. For one thing, unlike a lot of third-party candidates, like when John Anderson ran in 1980, Bloomberg can write his own checks. So if he wants to run, he can do so. The dissatisfaction we see in the country with the direction of the country and both political parties, low approval ratings for both the president and the Congress, you know, that creates a climate that is pretty friendly to a third-party bid.
I asked the mayor on the air last week how far he is from Senator Clinton or Senator Schumer on any of the issues. We can identify easily places where he's different from the national Republicans on some of the social issues and certainly guns. But how different is he from Senator Clinton and Senator Schumer? He ducked the question. So he's really, I think that would be part of the challenge for him, is being able to show America that he's not just a Democrat in independent clothing.
Yeah, maybe so. And historically, in recent history, New York has not been that great a place to be a presidential candidate from.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, New York City tap water versus bottled water on the environmental effects, the health effects. Oh, and that little thing we call taste. Stay with us.